This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is March 8th, year 2000. I'm at Agatha Norton's house, and we're going to be concluding the interview that I began with Agatha and Mary Ellen Roach Higgins a couple of weeks ago. We finished with Mary Ellen last time, and today we're going to be talking with Agatha about her teaching, research, and service. Agatha, let's begin with your teaching. Over the years, what were the courses that you taught most frequently?
Well, when I first came in 1956, I was teaching, I was an assistant professor, and I was teaching with senior professors, first of all in development of or design, fundamentals of design, with Professor Ruth Davis, and that was the first course. It was a service course that was taken by all of the home economics majors, and also students in several other programs, occupational therapy, many students in nursing, the architectural students in business. And it was a good, Ruth Davis was a great mentor. She did the lecturing. I assisted in lectures, run slides and things of that sort. But then I always had two or three studio or laboratory sections. Mm-hmm. Another course that I taught in that beginning, those beginning years, was 221, which was design and home planning, and that was with Professor Agnes Leindorf. And we had a 2 hours of lecture in that. Again, I assisted with the mechanics of lecture, and a 3 hour studio, which was architectural drawing and planning, space planning of the home. And soon I added another course, and that was in structural design of textiles. They related our 228. As I went on, I became involved in some other courses. Interior Design, 222, Fundamentals of Interior Design, which I taught with Mildred Garson, now Mildred Garson Lamb. And again, it was a good learning experience. And at this time, I was also working the course Arts for Occupational Therapy, Textile Arts for Occupational Therapy, which was a 2-credit course with 2-hour labs. And so there was no lecture, but I would be in charge of what I was doing there. As time went on, and after Mildred Garson Lamb left, I was left in charge of the costume design. First of all, a fundamental of costume design, apparel design, 225, both lectures and studios, three-credit course with 2 2-hour labs and an hour lecture, and also 425, which was the second costume design course. And these we developed for the apparel design majors. The courses had been on the list of the courses for the department. It was one of those, were all a part of the 13 courses that were in the catalog for the department when I began with the department. And there were, at the beginning, there were 6 faculty members, 2 of whom were full-time extension people. Mm-hmm. And before I finished, 30 years later, I had taught in, I think, 18 courses. And that's beside independent study and research and thesis and that sort of thing, independent study.
Was there any course that you taught a lot over your career, more than any other?
Yes, but I really taught most were the apparel design courses, and also carried through with the structural design, which was textile enrichment.
Now, taking a course like that, the apparel design one that you taught, how, over the course of your career here, how did that course, I assume that course evolved and changed as you went along.
Oh, indeed it did.
How did it change, and how did the students who you were teaching change?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the students, because over time, they did change. I saw the biggest change in students during the 60s when they became interested in careers, mm-hmm. professional mm-hmm. careers. Yeah. And if one wanted to get in trouble with students, the way to do it would be not to concentrate on professionalism for careers. And so that made it a very exciting mm-hmm. kind of teaching, because they were ready to absorb and follow, work on whatever you could present them with.
Were they more focused, would you say? Or
they were much more focused. Mm-hmm. And they had this period, I was working with more juniors and seniors who had chosen their major. And so they knew what they wanted to go on into, and this gave them focus. Mm-hmm. And made it much more exciting mm-hmm. teaching, because teaching is never exciting if you don't have students that are really wanting to grab mm-hmm. onto mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. you are offering them.
Well, what about the other half of that question was, how did what you teach change? Was it just more?
Yes, in the beginning, the costume design was largely teaching them how to sketch the fashion figure and how to evolve creative designs over that fashion figure. As time went on and they were going into professional work with manufacturing companies and also with some retailing and some career enrichment, the idea to develop much more creativity. The idea was getting them to learn how to come up with new ideas. It was a problem-solving mm-hmm. technique. Mm-hmm. And also, I found it expedient to help them to develop a sense of professional ethics and to learn to use their own talents. In fact, with these majors, when I would come into the first class in a semester, I would probably say something to them like this: "You know, you're going to have a lot of independence in working here, because in design you have to come up with original things, but it's very important for you to decide what direction you want to go and to make use of these problems, because if someday you are likely to come back and ask me for a recommendation. Mm-hmm. And I want you to know that I tell it like it is. Mm-hmm. And so if you are a goof off and you don't bother getting things done or pay much attention to them, that's part of the record. Mm-hmm. And if you are serious about this and work and develop a good bit of creativity, that becomes part of the record. So I won't tell you that again."
No. I'll bet you didn't have to.
Well, the courses came to be structured to offer very much more, and of course there'd be some historical background brought in. And one of the things that helped me greatly, I did quite a bit of traveling, and I always carried camera in hand and did a lot of photographing of people in costumes and of textiles in museums, textiles wherever I could find them. And those became part of my teaching materials. And I had costumes from many, many parts mm-hmm. of the world. And surprisingly, there are still people in many parts of the world who wear costumes quite different from our Western dress. Mm-hmm. And these offer inspiration, because from those you can develop modifications and get ideas. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was part of advancing the ideas. Learning, it became quite important to develop communication skills in technique, in designing, so that if they got good ideas, if they couldn't communicate them to their manufacturer or to their retailer or whomever they were working for, it didn't do them any good to have these bright ideas. Mm. And so it was a matter of how to put them down so that somebody else could read the ideas and react to them and to make them expressive. So communication, first of all designing, becoming creative, discovering problems, and probably another thing that was more developed in the courses as years went along was sources of design inspiration and relating these to the needs of manufacturers, relating their designs to the quality of textiles, the kinds of textiles available in the country or the location that they were designing for. And so it was another aspect of problem solving which had to become very important in teaching, so that they were well aware of it and had it in mind as they were designing.
Mm-hmm.
That's lives are the kinds of changes that took place.
What about, where was the computer when you retired? How far along was that introduced?
I regret that it wasn't very far along. We had an angel who had given the school a computer, a word processor. I think maybe there were two, but they were in the departmental office. And the secretaries were very hyper about it. We could hardly walk into the office. They were afraid we'd look at them. And there were, the university was offering some workshops with computers. And I wanted to go to these, but unfortunately in my last year or two, I was so busy tying off the work on some of the many committees that I worked on and preparing files and work for whoever would take over what I'd been doing, that I didn't get to these computer workshops. And so I did not get into the computers, and I know that very shortly they were being used. I was aware of what was happening because students began to be concerned that there might not be jobs in interior design. And they knew there were developments in technology coming along, and I said, well, now, look, and I took them on a field trip over to Milwaukee to a couple of manufacturers there, and they could see where previously the manufacturers had been cutting 250 layers of fabric at once. It would be stacked and pinned through so that it wouldn't slide, and the cutting instrument was more like, to me, like a bandsaw. Mm. The pattern was on top, and all of these were cut. This was part of the assembly line procedure. Well, the last time I took them to industry in Milwaukee, they could see the company cutting one layer of fabric at a time, and the cutting done to size for a specific individual. Here was the computer at work, and they said, now look, what's happening? Instead of designing so that they do several lots of 250 all alike, their designing can be for one individual.
Yeah, that's astonishing.
And so it is broadening the market.
I'm sure it changed the face of the curriculum and the department remarkably in the years shortly after your retirement.
It did, and it had to get, it did change it very, very rapidly after that. But one of the things that was always so exciting about teaching was that you had to be aware of what changes were on the horizon and to anticipate what was going to happen with these, as these changes came in, and to anticipate what the demands and the changes, the results would be. And that...
I mean, teaching is hard enough without having to have a crystal ball in front of you.
And that's right. You work with a crystal ball all the time.
Now, you mentioned that you taught courses with Agnes Leinsdorf and a few others. Do you mean that you team taught? These were team taught, or do you mean that you both just taught the same course at different...
No. What happened, and it happened in my courses, my last years too, where there would be one lecture for the course, or maybe two lectures, depending on how the course was structured. And the person in charge of the course gave the lecture, or directed, if an assistant was giving the lecture, which came to the point where I did that, but they told you what they wanted incorporated there, and then you built the lecture and the illustrative material for it. But the part that left the space for individual teaching was the laboratory or studio work, and it was in studio. So in science you call it laboratory, in design we tend to call it studio. The thing that you were busy doing then was helping individuals to develop their own creativity, mm-hmm. their own creative problem solving. Mm-hmm. So that meant they had to be able to identify, to recognize and identify problems, and then develop creative solutions mm-hmm. for them and get them down on paper so that they could communicate them mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. whoever mm-hmm. they were designing for.
Interesting. You taught many courses over the years. Did your approach to teaching change throughout the course of your career? Or evolve, I should say, change?
Did my teaching...
Approach to teaching
my
change?
My approach to teaching change. I think probably I became more aware of the importance of helping students to develop values, because at one time values had been sort of a nasty word in education. Mm-hmm. That was something we didn't speak about years ago. But you, a professional without a sense of values is not going to be the best kind of professional. And so it was finding ways to raise questions as to what their personal goals were and their goals of professional creativity were. Always, from the beginning, for as long as I taught, I think I was pretty much aware that the educator is not the learner, but the educator or teacher makes learning possible. Mm-hmm. And that means that you pose problems for the student, and you may have to help them to supply some tools to think with or to communicate with. But it's a problem-solving process, because the solutions have to be original, or it's copywork, mm-hmm, it's not mm-hmm, design. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Did you enjoy teaching?
I loved it. When I was a high school student, I knew I didn't want to be a teacher. And I was going into a science career. Dietetics seemed to be the direction I was traveling, and I was told that the way to get to that was in a school of home economics. And the school of home economics I attended, I had to take the education courses. And to my surprise, when I got to the education courses and student teaching, I liked it. And then I only spent 47 years teaching.
Well, you're lucky that you liked it then, if you just had to spend 47 years doing it.
The interesting thing about many facets of home economics is that you're not fenced in. Mm. And you can do many other kinds of things. In fact, in summer, because there weren't summer sessions in secondary education, I did things. I worked in the cherry orchards 1 year in charge of meal planning. So here my food background came in. Even though I had discovered that I did not want to make the major part of my work food management, it was fun for a summer, working with traveling crews.
Let's get to students. Let's go back to students for just one moment. We may have talked about this a little bit earlier in the interview, but home ec had a unique situation in that in other schools, when I talk to people, we talk about the entrance of females into the school. Lots of schools were basically all male in their student orientation until the 50s and 60s. But in home ec, everything's different. It's all women initially, and then men make their way into the world, both the teaching and the student. When did men start making their way into home ec?
Oh, I suppose it was in the 60s, and you're right. I don't think it was simultaneous, but I can't tell you which came first, the male professors or the male students. Mm. But I remember quite well some of the male students. The women students enjoyed having them in class. There'd be one or maybe two, and one that I recall quite vividly was George Bacon. And George ended up in his own career. I'm not sure, it may have been Verona, but some town around here, he ran a tech shop, which is designing and supplying ready-to-wear for people who ride horses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another one that I recall was Ed Mayer. And he was interested in textiles, and Ed ended up in the textile specialty in the University of, in the museum at Los Angeles. Mm. That was his specialty. Another male student that I won't forget was Timothy Coleman. Timothy was about a 250-pound football player who was here on football scholarship.
Oh, my.
And so he was in the art department because he couldn't play football and earn his scholarship and be gone to New York for the apparel design program. So he was working through regular design, working through art, and taking the courses in apparel design. Timothy was a black man, and again, he enjoyed the class, and the students enjoyed having him. And one, to my surprise, he wasn't treated, in my mind, he wasn't treated any different than any other student. But before he left, he came in to thank me, because I always treated him like a human being. Mm. And this caught me so much by surprise, because he was a good designer. He had goals. He was what we were in business for, and so we were working with him. But at this time, we did have men first came into nutritional science courses, and
about what year would that be?
Well, it was when nutritional science was still in the School of Home Economics, before it was taken over by the College of Agriculture, and I think it was the early 60s. And but eventually we had men in interior design, several of them, Roger Kramer, and Bob Bartholomew was the last one, and Bob has just retired. And he had worked in industry before he came, so he had a good handle on designing for industry as well as designing for home. And of course, this was a direction that all of the specialties within our department, which was dealing with quality of the environment, they were all involved to some extent with industry. The textile design, or apparel design, interior design, or the housing major.
So part of your job was to keep that relationship with industry.
That's right,
Let's talk for just a moment about, you mentioned some of the male students that you had over the years. Everybody has their own favorite students over time. Who are some of your, who are some of the students who just sort of jump out at you?
Well, I suppose we work more closely with graduate students, because they're, you have a smaller group of them. But several of those come to mind. One, of course, that comes to mind first is Joy Dorr. Well, I knew Joy from the time she was a freshman. And then she went on, she married, she had a family. She got a master's degree in our school, and then she got her PhD in the School of Education. And she, of course, has gone on to full professorship.
Yeah, I met Joy. She seems like a delightful person.
Very able.
Beverly
Owen went to work at the University of Tennessee, and Beverly was a student in the early years I was on campus, and I will always remember, you know, you remember people who make you think, and I met Beverly on the stairs, and one of the education professors had sent her to talk with me because she was trying to make up her mind whether she was going to gear her degree to working with college students or to work with secondary students. And so she came to ask me, you know, what's the difference in teaching in high school or teaching in college? And I think it was the first time I had really faced it, although I had certainly been living with it, because you adjust to whatever you are working with. And I said, well, you know, in secondary work, you spend half of your time on motivation and getting students to want to learn because they have to do the learning. And you spend another part on discipline, organization, another 50%. And what time you have left over you spend on subject matter. And in college teaching, they are mature young adults. They are self-disciplined. And they have chosen what they want to study, so they are motivated already when you get them. So you supply the learning situations and help them to direct their learning to their professional goals.
There you go.
Yeah. I think one of the things that changed in teaching through the years was that there was such urgency for leadership in education and research in the programs in design and material, whether it be housing, interiors, or apparel. And so you not only were gearing the subject matter for the student learning, but you also needed to be giving them some experiences that would help them to develop leadership with whomever they might be working with, and directing them toward research, because there was this growing change in technology, there were changes in social life, changes in economics. That change, we could recognize, was going to be ongoing. And so they not only would have to learn what we were doing at the moment, but they had to be geared to do problem solving, problem identification, problem solving. As things change, the economy, materials available, the technology in producing, and so on. So it meant that even with undergraduates, we had to give them a kind of research orientation so that they would recognize that they had to identify the new problems they were facing and to figure out what to do about it.
You mentioned one thing that's interesting, and that was the use, you developed the use of fashion shows starting in about 1983. Could you talk about how that idea came about and how you implemented it?
Well, we had students who were doing a good job of creative design in apparel design, and it's important as far as their satisfaction is concerned for them to have people see the designs that they're doing. And it's also important as far as employment to have people, places, organizations that might have position openings to be aware that here is a place that there are good design professionals being brought out. And so we had the first fashion show that I had in recent years. There was in 1983. It was fashion as an art form. It was original apparel designed by students, and we had the show at the Albion Museum of Art. Subsequently, in 1984, 85, 86, each year, the students who had created these designs, and they would have done them in both either or flat pattern or draping. So they had actually produced them. They had designed the garments, and then they had produced them. And that was a good way of having them get exposure, as well as giving them a goal to work for. Because if they knew their designs were going to be shown, they would want to do something that was...
be motivated, yeah.
Yeah.
How long did that continue?
I think they're still having them. I know that the people who followed me and the work that I did had them for 2 or 3 years, but I think they've continued. I don't get the brochure on them anymore to be invited to show, but the staff has changed.
Yeah, right.
So that made a difference.
Let's move now to research and talk about that for a while. And we've talked about this in different places throughout the course of the interview, but let's try to pull it together right here. Describe the research environment in the department when you came and how that changed over the years.
Well, I believe that Matilda Vandenberg-Schwalbach was doing some research in textile printing when I came, And she did develop some good coursework and had some good students, but primarily she had to start with figuring out how to use the materials currently available to prepare the screens, mm-hmm. methods of preparing the screens for printing, mm-hmm. kinds of dyes to use, because this changed over time, and better dyes for direct printing became available. She also did some research in resist dyeing, that is, preparing parts of the fabric so that the dye will not permeate.
Mm.
And of course, batik is one typical kind of traditional resist dyeing.
Some of the early research?
Some of the early research that I did was methods of using the sewing machine as a creative art tool.
Mm.
Now, this meant, this wasn't just plain applique, it meant figuring out ways in which you could nullify the sewing machine's mechanical advancement of fabric for stitches and manually control the direction and the length and the speed of the stitches.
Oh my.
And I learned several ways of doing this.
Did you figure these out, or did you learn them from other people? Or
I didn't find any place that was in print, and because I had used the machine that had been a sewing tool for me mm-hmm. for a long time, I was familiar with what you could do with it. Well, it was to either lower the feed dog so that that would not grab the material and carry it along, or release the pressure on the presser foot, or substitute a spring kind of device so that you didn't have the feed pulling the fabric along, and also either stiffening the material in a hoop, and you have to choose hoops that would be small enough that you could move them within the space under the arm of the machine. You didn't have a lot of space to work there, but you could use a 6 or 8 inch, 10 inch hoop and move it around, or using material that was stiffened, either naturally stiff, like denim, to get denim with body, you can move it with your hands, moving in whatever direction mm-hmm. you want to go, whatever speed you have to. You have to control, learn to control the speed of the machine, the motor, or if it happened to be using an old treadle machine, you can control the speed of that. But it's controlling the speed with which you move the fabric and the direction in which it goes. And then, of course, you have all the problems of color, and you mm-hmm. change the color. You can mm-hmm. also couch the threads on, again, putting on another attachment that carries a heavier thread, and with a zigzag or a swing needle machine, you can move the fabric so that it couches that fabric, that cording in place. Well, that was one kind of direction that I moved. Another kind of research that I did, and I did have a grant for this one from DPI, Department of
Public Instruction.
Instruction. And that was finding emerging occupations in interior, apparel, and textile design, and career opportunities and competencies that were involved. I was a co-investigator in that. But that was a very interesting kind of research, because it fed directly into our program development and the developing the courses to support the training or education of professionals here. It meant also keeping in contact with industry, and because industry was changing and technology was changing. And so I had a whole list of Wisconsin manufacturers that I kept in touch with, Junior House in Milwaukee, Jack Winter, Eagle Knitting. There were quite a few of them. There were a few up in the Wisconsin Valley. And to find out what they were looking for in designers, to visit them, to get their PR people to take me through their plants so I could see what kinds of changes were coming. what kinds of changes in material, what kinds of changes in the mechanics that they were following, and so that we could alert students and perhaps develop some kinds of experiences for them in that. And Florence Eisman in Milwaukee was another one that that really worked. We, in this contact with industry, we were also working to make the manufacturers aware of the kinds of designers that we were turning out, to open occupational opportunities for them. And it took a couple of years, but eventually our graduates were in employ in most of these Wisconsin industries. And with the apparel design majors, these students, most of them had gone to New York, the Fashion Institute of Technology. I think we talked about that
yes,
earlier.
We did.
But many of them went to work in New York, and some of them worked as students. And many of the companies wanted to continue to employ them after their graduation. Some of them, it was interesting because about half of the students could not, the ones that studied in New York at FIT, they couldn't wait to get back to New York, and the other half didn't want ever to see New York again. And so that left another thing for us to investigate, was to find other places that they could be employed.
Mm.
And the last investigation that I retired too soon to get to was to find out what was happening in Chicago, because a lot of the manufacturing industry was moving to Chicago.
Oh.
And I was looking for support in doing that search. The Wisconsin search I did on my own wheels and take, but I didn't have a class and get around, because of course Saturday wasn't a good day to visit industry either. And so that we channeled the information we got. It went in two directions. Our information went to the manufacturers, and the manufacturers' information came to us and flowed into our program and to our students. And I think the department continued work with textile screen printing processes, and they, when I retired, they were moving into some computerized design, and so was the weaving.
Yeah.
Computerized weaving.
Yeah, well, all that stuff is computerized now. I've seen some of our artists from the art department getting involved in computer work, which leads me to something, another question I wanted to ask for a while. You mentioned that you got involved in research, and you've talked about some of your sewing techniques and some of the results that came from that. Now, traditionally, research at the university is measured in articles written for scholarly journals and books published by scholarly presses. You guys, you in particular, and some of the other design people, and the people in the art department kind of created a different situation, though, because your work was not something that appeared in scholarly journals. Your work appeared in juried shows and things like that. How was that war waged or situation?
There's an interesting parallel, because when research articles go into juried journals, they have to be showing some new problem solution, and whatever is being investigated, it's new information or new ways of doing things that are being worked out. The juried shows, you have to be showing original creative work, and in my case it was textile design, usually structural design of textiles, structural enrichment, and you had to be, you were coming up with new ideas expressed through structural design of textiles, or it could be new techniques, and those of course would help to sprout new ideas that would be communicated within textiles. So that the juried show really was parallel in expressing the same kind of originality in problem solving that the juried journal was. And that was the route that I took for my publication. And
how did people like Dean Pound, for example, how did people from the Ag School, did they understand what you were talking about and what you were trying to do, or was that ever an issue at that level?
It never became an issue for me, and I don't know, it may have been the fact that the art department had juried shows accepted. The other thing, see, I was traveling kind of a parallel track, parallel tracks in research, in that I was doing this investigation on changes in industry brought about by changes in materials, technology, and how to use that in textiles or interiors. And along with that, of course, went into writing. You had lists, and you had all of these material ideas that you were putting down. And so, as far as I was concerned, I never knew of a question being raised. But I saw my own work, my own creativity, being exhibited more in the original textiles in juried shows. It may have been, I don't know just why, but I that was the direction I took.
One of the interesting things about having you and Mary Ellen together has been Mary Ellen took such a different approach. She got that training at Michigan State, and she got her PhD in cultural anthropology, I think it was. And so she was writing more or less the traditional scholarly articles.
That's
and,
right.
And you were doing your own thing. Yours is a much more artistic approach and much more design-oriented. What about some of the other members of the department, other types of research going on? What other things were going on in the department?
Well, Joy Doerr was doing research, and I think she has continued with that, with housing and living situations for the elderly. I think Bob Bartholomew was working with originating, changing, or solving the changing problems in design of interiors, both industrial and residential interiors. In the textile design, the weaving was going into computerizing, and so was the textile printing going into computerizing. And I left a little bit early to get out of the computer wagon.
That's interesting. In terms of the evolution of your own research, you talked about the sewing. Did it move in a standard way? How did your research change over time?
Well,
or your art, I guess you would say.
My research became, I guess it became more geared to what I could transfer from my learnings, my problem solving, to students, and it was developing a more professional recognition of problems, finding current problems and solutions to current problems, be it in apparel or textiles, and transferring these kinds of learnings, problem identification, problem solving, getting students geared to pick up on this so that they would carry on in their own careers, because each person going into their career is going to have a little different track forming, because one generation solves problems. The next generation comes along and thinks, well, what, my forebears didn't do anything. They didn't solve any problems. And they get that impression because there's a whole new spate of problems that have originated. And so it's realizing that problem solving keeps changing because problems keep changing. It's an evolutionary process.
And that's what you were facing too, Donna. I don't know if I've interviewed many people whose departments have gone through as many changes as yours has gone, as yours went through in your years there, and just entering the computer years as you left. I mean, you came in this totally different department, which transformed dramatically over the course of the years.
It has. It's dramatically different. It's expanded in so many directions. And because, because we kept on the cutting edge the number of students grew, the number of kinds of positions or careers available grew. If we had settled down and just stuck with what we were always doing, we wouldn't have been helping students to face the new things in the world. But because we stayed on the edge of it and kept identifying the changes and really trying to anticipate the changes so that we could be in gear as the needs and the occupational opportunities arose, we would have graduates online, either in process of learning or finishing programs. And one of the things the students had to learn was that their education should never stop, because change never stops. And so they had to continue with this intellectual curiosity and the ability to keep looking and thinking and developing and being able to confront the new situations. And that's part of the excitement of all the kinds of careers that we were preparing students for. There's a kind of excitement when you are geared for change.
What about all this change going on? You were going to professional meetings, which we'll get to in a little while, but were the other colleges experiencing that same kind of change?
The other colleges that were handling home economics, by whatever name? Yes. I think, well, the ones that stayed in business were. I think like Columbia, I think, dropped their home economics. I think Penn State, if I'm not mistaken, dropped theirs. So you either had to grow or drop out.
You, of course, showed your work in numerous exhibitions. What do you consider to be your most important or interesting or intriguing exhibition that you participated in?
Well, one that I did in 1972 was a kind of recognition that meant a lot to me. The photographs and description of my handcrafted textiles were published in the American Home Economics Association Journal, and they purchased two of my textiles that were in the show for the permanent headquarters collection. That was a competitive exhibition and sponsored by the American Home Economics Association in Washington, D.C. in 1972. And one that was a little earlier than that, sort of parallel to it, the original textile work selected for the North Central Regional Crafts Exhibition, and they called it Craftsman USA 66, was a juried selection from 11 different states. When you can get into a large competition and you have work selected, it's kind of a meaningful thing professionally for you. And those two were particularly meaningful. You know, I had one person chose, Sun Prairie, a number of those, but when you're in the competition with people in your field of work over a large area and you make it into the show, that is recognition that is enjoyable to the participant.
Through these shows and through your work, did you get to know certain other designer, quote, slash artists from other home economics schools in the area?
Well, I did, and that came more through area meetings where we get to know them, because many of the shows, you mailed the thing to the show, or you mailed pictures. First of all, you had photographs, and then they decided they wanted, if they would accept an entrance of those particular photographs, those particular textiles that you sent the photographs of, so you got accepted or turned down through photographs. But the meetings that were regional meetings of educators in the area, that would be where you meet the people who were also producing, and that was always a joyful kind of contact.
When you work at the University of Wisconsin as a faculty member, you're obligated to sit on a three-legged stool, and that's one of the legs is teaching, and one of the legs is research, and the third leg is service. And it's a component that not all people are that aware of in terms of that being a major part of a professor's job. But one of the ways you serve the university is by serving on committees. I noticed that you have a number of committees that you served on throughout the course of time, but I don't think we need to address all of them. But let's talk about one or two that you might think is your most important committees.
Well, one that I was most excited about was in 1975, where I was chairperson of the Chancellor's Distinguished Teaching Awards Committee. And I always remember when it came to sorting through, I had a good committee to work with, but I also had a stack about, several stacks really. I had a 12-foot ceiling in my office, and the stacks of credentials, vita that came from the various departments recommending some of their co-workers for this award was stacked to the ceiling in my office. So we had to sort through that. But the exciting part of it was finding out what these people were doing, whose co-workers wanted to recommend them for the distinguished teaching awards. And there was a monetary award attached to that, so that I've forgotten how much they got, but I know it was at least $1,000 was the least one, so that there was a reward coming through. And but these people were recommended by co-workers. They didn't do their own, they didn't recommend themselves. And to find out what they were doing that their co-workers in departments clear across the university thought were praiseworthy and worthy of distinguished recognition, that was an exciting kind of job.
What was your role in that? Did you had to read through all those and
Had to review them all and go through them and see. You know, some of them might not have as much. Some of them had so much that you could eliminate the ones that didn't give you enough information, just by the scarcity of information. But we had to read through that, and so we had a good committee who worked through it, worked through the stacks, and pulled out the ones that they thought the whole committee needed to look at. And we did. I think there were five winners that year, and that was about the number of awards. I did it a second year, and I think there were six winners, and they thought they couldn't decide between two. And so they thought, well, send that back to the chancellor's office to make a decision. And they did. They found another award.
The six got awards. Now, the chancellor at that point was Ed Young?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Did you get to talk to him at all or meet
with
him?
Oh, yes. And it was, that was very interesting to talk with Chancellor Young and to see, you know, what his ideas were and what he wanted us to look for.
What was your impression of Chancellor Young?
Well, I greatly admired him. I thought he was a great leader for the university and quite impartial, so that we felt we had to do an impartial kind of job, too, on the, for the committee.
Now, since we're on the topic of chancellors and we haven't really talked about them before, I remember you mentioning to me, this is off mic, that talked for a second about Chancellor Shane. What were your impressions of Chancellor Shane?
Well, Chancellor Shane was in office when the School of Home Economics became an independent school. Mm-hmm. And we really were very pleased with that kind of recognition. Some years previously, under some previous chancellor, we had been, I had been told by the dean of the college that there was thought of doing away with the school. And so Chancellor Shane's recognition of what we were doing and feeling that we should be freed to work independently and to grow with what we were doing, we were very, very pleased with that kind of recognition.
Was that feeling that the department could possibly be eliminated, was that something that was in all of your, the back of all of your minds? Did you take that seriously?
Well, we didn't anticipate it happening.
Yeah.
But when it happened, we realized that there was a challenge and we should live up to it. And I think we did.
Good.
We tried, but I think we succeeded. Yeah. And it was a very exciting department to work in, because there were challenges coming in from so many directions, and we got the support. That was what happened. If you get challenges and you get bright ideas, but you don't get support to carry them out, then the fun is gone.
Well, I must say again, I've said this on numerous occasions, that I wasn't familiar with your department at all until we started working together, and I'm just astonished at the number of changes and challenges you people were going through. It must have seemed like almost on a daily basis for a number of years. And I suspect that when Chancellor Shane recognized you, that must have been a very nice feeling.
It was. Well, he recognized what we were recognizing as far as the changes in social and economic aspects of family living, and the changes that technology were bringing. He had to have been aware of it and felt that we were up to the challenge of meeting and coming up with solutions, recognizing problems and up with solutions.
Okay, getting back to the business at hand, you did join several professional organizations. How important was membership in professional organizations? Was this something that was really vital to you, crucial to you?
Well, it was to me. We weren't pushed to do it, but I had become, some years earlier, I had become a life member of what was then called the American Association of Home Economics, and as they became, they've now changed their name to American Association of Family and Consumer Sciences. Mm-hmm. Home economics across the board has changed names. But I had always been a member, and I had served on some national committees in the arts. I also had served on the state association for home economics. I think I'd been vice president, and I'd also been on a number of committees and on their board, so that it made you aware of what was going on nationally and statewide, and gave an opportunity for some input, mm-hmm. as to a vision that one could contribute through these associations. And so that made it important, because it being both a national and then a state association, they had some authority to carry on the work and to give publication to the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a team kind of thing. You're willing to work with it, and then you get the support through publication or whatever.
Yeah. And the sense of a shared experience.
That's
too,
right.
That you're all.
Yes, and you find out that we weren't alone in going through these changes, because social, economic, and technological changes were going on across the country, and so people in all various areas were affected by it. That's a nice thing about the United States, the broad country, and yet the interlinking all the way across.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it when I read about the little countries in Europe and the walls around them and the ethnic animosities. We don't have to fight that.
Yeah.
We have a great unity. That's a real advantage that we can be thankful for.
In these large national organizations on home ec, did they sort of have meeting committees that would set sort of standard policy for the? I mean, I understand that everybody was autonomous to a certain extent, but
yes, they did. Of later years, after I retired from professional work, they had national committees that pass on the merit of the various kinds of work. I can't give you too much information about that, because there seemed to be other things that mm-hmm. took more of my attention, mm-hmm. as long as I wasn't mm-hmm. involved and working directly with it.
Well, one of the things you mentioned, I think it was off mic very early on, you talked about the importance, one of the things that you emphasized was the importance of art in everyday life. Was that something that you talked about at the National Convention? How important was that concept to you?
Well, it was a concept that was important to all of home economics. We talked about the changes of name and the increasing professionalization, but from the beginning, this field I still go back to call it home economics. Well, they're
now it's not, human ecology. Yeah,
right.
An odd but name, human ecology.
By any name,
can't warm up to it.
This field had four areas of family concern. Always, it's been family concern.
Hold on, we're going to change. There were four areas of family concern.
Yes, the four areas are: one, physical well-being; two, quality of material environment; three, the management of consumer resources; and four, family stability. Those are still primary areas of family concern, and the must be noted that the social, economic changes and technological developments in the United States during the past millennium have increased and broadened the choices with which American families and individuals, individual family members, are confronted. As educators of students for professional careers, we needed to be on the cutting edge of change, anticipating the effects of these ongoing changes and planning to meet the needs of our students and of families.
There's one other thing that was going on paralleling your all of your changes in your department and your school, and it's relevant and obviously let me just get on to it. And that's the women's movement. You have the women's movement going on across the country. You have large changes in home ec. Did the women's movement impact at all on the direction and feelings and whatnot in the home ec?
I think we were the original women's movement.
Okay.
I don't think we felt so much change. And the home economics had never been anti-male,
mm-hmm.
but we did begin to have more men coming out of faculty and more male students.
Mm-hmm.
But at first, it wasn't that we tended to exclude them as much as I think they excluded themselves,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because that was women's work.
Mm-hmm.
But we, being interested in the whole family, we were never exclusive.
So when the men came in, it was sort of an acknowledgement of
well,
that fact. Yeah.
Glad to have them aboard. Yeah. If they had picked up on a specialty that they needed to serve in some area of our study and education, welcome aboard.
You noted that you had taken several trips abroad. We don't need to go into all of them, but why don't you talk about one or two of the more interesting opportunities you had? You did some marvelous traveling.
Well, it was a wonderful way to get the worldwide influence because these changes, they don't happen in lockstep across the world, but to be aware of them was helpful. I thought about these trips and wondered how I could pick out one, because each one, as I was involved in it, was the most important,
mm-hmm.
at the moment. But looking back, the one that probably meant the most to my teaching was a couple of months that I spent in Southeast Asia, and that was back in 1962, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And among the countries, we had a few Asian students. We had had some Filipino students, and I met some of those, heard that I was with the University of Wisconsin Extension Group when we were traveling there, and word seemed to get around that the UW group was coming to town, and some of these students came to find out excuse me, if we were on the tour, and to welcome us, and a Filipino student, one that I had not known, was here before I came, came to take me out to dinner. And when I got to Hong Kong, another student had been there. She brought her brother with her, and they took us to dinner in Hong Kong.
Mm.
And it was they wanted to show us their town. This was part of it for each of them. They wanted to see their country.
Sure.
Well, I got to Korea, and this was shortly after the Korean War. And we've, again, UW tour being in town, word got around, and we'd have more students approaching college age who would gather to talk to us and, you know, how do I get to the University of Wisconsin, and that sort of question. But I got to learn quite a bit about the culture and the homes in Korea, and I found it such a helpful thing in, we began having more and more Korean students, and to be able to relate the courses that I was teaching to their needs. At the time, I had some of the first Korean students. I was teaching a home planning course where we started out with a 1,500 square foot house and doing original plans, you know, using strips of paper for moving walls and that sort of thing, so we didn't have a lot of erasing to do and making changes. But after going through this home planning of this home, I said to one of the Korean students, "No, you're not going back to Korea to build an American house. What did you get in this course that you can use?" And she said, "Oh, well, first of all, I wouldn't put that closet inside the front door, because we take our shoes off on the porch and we leave them on the porch. And that fireplace, well, I could understand that because we took our shoes off when we visited Korean homes too. That fireplace, we wouldn't have a fireplace there because we have the fireplace out behind the house, and then there is a flue goes through under the floor, and we sit on the floor, and so the floor is nice and warm. And so there wouldn't be a fireplace in there." And she continued on with some of these analyses, and I thought, okay, the course, I had to gear it to the American students because they were by far the majority, but this Korean student was seeing the connections, and she also, she said, she could put the design down. She had learned architectural drawing in the class, and she could put down her ideas so that a builder could understand what she was talking about. And that was another tool that she had, and felt it was valuable. Mm-hmm. So, in being able to save these students who were in a strange country, first time away from home probably, and you know, what's your hometown? "Well, I came from Seoul." "Oh, I was in Seoul." Mm-hmm. And tell them something that you had seen there, but they just relaxed and they felt so at home that you knew where they were from and what it was like there. And I found that with some of the other Southeast Asian countries too, but we had far more Korean students than any other.
Did you have a lot of Asian students?
We had a lot of them. You find some Korean.
What accounts for that?
Well, apparently the GIs that were in Korea were liked. And they learned about the United States and thought that was a good place to come. And I had an interesting telephone call just yesterday. Quite a surprise. It was a former student from Pakistan. And sure, I remembered her. And she said, well, she wanted me to know. She was single when she was here, and she married after she went back to Pakistan. And she has three daughters. And she wanted me to know that it was her education here and people she worked with at the University of Wisconsin that made her want to send her children to the United States for education. And she has two at Yale and one at Harvard.
Oh my.
Wow.
Whoa.
And they are planning. I said, well, are they planning on staying in this country? Are they getting professionally trained to go back? But they were planning on staying in this country. She's staying in Pakistan. And apparently, to have been here in the first place, she probably had resources at home and obviously has resources to have three kids in college and at Yale and Harvard.
Well, Pakistan is pretty much of a hot spot right now.
It is, and apparently she's able to get her children out of there, but she's going back herself. Yeah. But I guess she was here going to the East Coast to visit the children, but she came back to follow the paths that she had walked on the university campus.
And just yesterday?
Yeah, it was yesterday.
Boy, is she lucky. It was 71 degrees yesterday on March 7th.
Oh, it's about to know if I had Matilda Schwalbach's number. Oh. Well, I was writing to her, and I would get it. She's going to telephone me when she gets back to Pakistan.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's wonderful. I always like to include a section on honors and awards. You've won several and many throughout the course of your career. Are there any that maybe mean just a little bit more to you than the other ones?
Two do.
Can you talk about them briefly?
Okay. Well, there were two awards that really were very meaningful to me. One I received in 1970. I was a recipient of the Alumni Distinguished Service Award from the University of Wisconsin-Stout. Now, that was my undergraduate alma mater. Mm-hmm. And that was very meaningful that they had followed me and made recognition of it. I got a silver bowl, which I had for that.
Did you go up for the, was it presented at a...
It was presented at a reception in the nominee, so I drove up for it and get recognition at the meeting and came back with the silver bowl. And another one that was very meaningful was the recognition by the Wisconsin Home Economics Alumni Association. That was in May 1984, and that was for faculty professional excellence in the School of Family Resources and Consumer Sciences here in Madison. And these two recognitions were coming from one's peers and one's co-workers, and to be singled out in each of these cases for that particular recognition was very meaningful.
That's very nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
When did you decide to retire?
Well, I decided to retire a couple of years before I did. Actually, well, Elizabeth Simpson was dean. I thought I had reached the high water mark. And she said, oh, why don't you stay? I'm going to be here one more year. Why don't you stay on and we'll go out together? Hmm. Well, okay, she was a very fine person to work with, and I was feeling well, able, so I stayed on. And the next year I was ready to retire, and two of the men from my department, Manfred Wentz and Bob Bartholomew, came to me individually, and I don't think this was planned as a cold job, but they each asked me to stay on. And they said, look, we need you. And I figured they were going to be glad to see me gone, because I was never one who kept my opinions to myself. And,
So that led you to stay for one additional year?
I stayed two additional
years. One for Elizabeth, that's what I meant. One for her department, and two for...
Yeah.
And so when did you finally retire?
Retired in May 1986.
Okay, now, what kind of activities have you been... did you stay in touch with the department at all, in terms of actively stay in touch with them?
No, not too much. The staff had changed. There have been a great many turnovers. There have been more retirements and changes in deanship and all sorts of things. But and of course I'm out here in the boonies. We're 6 miles from campus. There's enough going on out here that I haven't gone back. Although I was always interested, I like to stay on the grapevine and know what was happening. Mm-hmm. But I continued to do. I continue to do some traveling, continue to do some creative textile work, and do a lot more reading and running around, visiting the things that I couldn't do in the years when I was in schedule. I always wondered why I would hear, but before I retired, I kept hearing my retired friends talking about how busy they were. And I used to think, oh, Pethel, busy. I know what it is to be busy. But when they retired, I found out what they were talking about. You know, it's all that decision making. When you are employed, your time is structured, and you have pretty well defined things
that you've got to do.
Where you produce. When you retire, you have all these choices of things that you're interested in doing, and which shall I do first? Mm-hmm. It's that decision making that makes you feel so busy.
Well, you also showed me your room downstairs before the interview. I'm at your house. The rest of the interviews had been conducted at Mary Ellen's. And I was struck by the amount of artwork that you did. And you said you have a working workroom down there.
Yeah.
So what are you working on right now?
Well, I'm always working a little bit on textiles. Mm-hmm. And I have one wall with pin board that I put it up on, because working on a textile is like working on a painting. You have to look at it and react to it for a while. Mm-hmm. It isn't something like beating up the recipe for a cake, mm-hmm. where you just go from mm-hmm. half cup of this to the cup of that and finally put it in the oven. It's a creative process, and you come to the point where there needs to be some time mm-hmm. to react to it. And so you pin it up, and sometimes I have at least two or three things going at a time. Mm-hmm. I always like to do apparel design in an interest, so I still like to do some creative work in that. Although fashion hasn't been inspiring, this one size fits all, we've had fashion for so long.
That's interesting, yeah. Hmm. It's a wonderful room, by the way. Some of the textile works you have on the walls, I've never seen anything quite like them before. They're very exciting. And it is exactly like going into an art gallery, only it's textiles instead of canvas.
That's right.
Which is...
That's how I use textiles.
Yep, it's very obvious. I always give my interviewees a chance to have the last word. Do you have any closing comments you'd like to make about your career at the University of Wisconsin?
Well, personally, I have found it a very exciting and satisfying career, helping young people to identify their abilities and interests and to work toward reaching their individual potential in an area that is of significant family concern, quality of material environment. Now, that has come through identifying emerging career areas. Second thing, leading in cooperative development of departmental programs, supportive of career preparation for the emerging careers related to quality of material environment. And perhaps the most exciting, providing supportive consultation for students in relating their interests, talents, and abilities to the quality of material environment. And that the reward has come through hearing, still occasionally, from former students and what they're doing and why they're glad that they got where they did and why their careers developed.
I think on that is a very suitable last word. Thank you very much, Agatha. It's been very enjoyable.
Thank you. It's been interesting bringing it all back.